Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Welcome to Radio Oldie. I'm Charlotte Metcalfe, and today I'm thrilled to be in conversation with a man widely hailed as Britain's most popular and successful choreographer. Since 1986, Matthew Bourne has been creating and directing dance for musicals, theatre and film. His Swan Lake, which opened in 1995, with male dancers replacing the female swans, is the world's longest-running full-length dance classic in the West End and on Broadway. Matthew is a record-breaking 9 times winner of the Olivier Award and the only British director to have won the Tony Award for both Best Choreographer and Best Director of a Musical. In 2015, he was the first dance figure to win the Stage Award for Outstanding Contribution to British Theatre from the UK Theatre Awards. And in 2016, he was knighted for services to dance and awarded the coveted Queen Elizabeth II Coronation Award in recognition of his outstanding contribution to the art of ballet. Phew, Matthew Bourne, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Very nice to be here, Charlotte. Thank you.
Well, it's so exciting to be talking to you at this time of year, just as we're right into the Christmas festive season and that moment when families are introducing and taking their children to ballet. So let's start by you telling us about Red Shoes, which is playing in London right now at Sadler's Wells, where you're an associate artist.
Yes, well, I got dubbed the King of Christmas a few years ago because I have these shows on every year at Sadler's Wells. I think it's our 24th consecutive Christmas season at Sadler's Wells this year, something like that, 23rd or 24th, depending on whether you count the year we couldn't perform because of COVID. But it's wonderful because it's become a Christmas tradition for a lot of families to come to Sadler's Wells at Christmas and see one of my shows. And we've got great several shows in the rep now. I've got 13 or 14 full length pieces that we bring out from time to time, and the Red Shoes is this year, and it's like a love letter to theatre. It's my personal love letter to theatre. It's as much about theatre and movies as it is about dance, because it's about something we can all appreciate, which is that pull between a central figure, Victoria Page. She has this pull between her career and her love life, I suppose. So she has this classic thing of these two passions in her life, you know, and I think that's why the piece works for a lot of people. It's we can all kind of identify with that in some way.
So you're very influenced by the movies, which were, because you love the movies, which is, I think, probably why your work is so unbelievably accessible to everybody. But let's get on to that. Can we go back to where you grew up? Because you grew up in Hackney, didn't you? And your mum was secretary and your dad worked for Thames Water, I've read somewhere.
That's right.
You didn't go to your first ballet till you were 18, did you?
No, I actually was born in Hackney, but brought up in Walthamstow, E17. Uh-huh. And I was lucky to live in London. I was lucky to have parents that like going to see things. So they took me to the cinema a lot. They took me to the theatre a lot. I mean, we were always in the cheapest seats, right at the very top, looking down the tops of the heads of lots of very famous actors and dancers and singers and people. That fired me up at a very early age. I mean, I was theatre going from about the age of 14. In the West End. I used to get on 38 bus and go up to the West End from Walthamstow and see shows on my own.
Is it true that you also went and got autographs? You wrote to people Betty Davis, and that's amazing.
Yes. I was one of London's premier autograph collectors for a few years, at quite a young age, but I suppose about 14 to 16. Were my prime years of doing that, and met everyone. You know, it was mid-70s, so I encountered briefly most amazing people. Fred Astaire, as you said, and Charlie Chaplin I met face-to-face.
No!
Betty Davis, as you said. people who are long gone, like Josephine Baker, you know, people like this, legends, you know, I actually met face to face.
How?
Well, I just knew where they were going to be and I waited for them.
Oh, you literally did the standing outside the stage door thing with your autograph book.
Or hotels, weekends and things. I went to a lot of opening nights with my friend Simon. After school, we used to get on the bus and go up into the West End any opening night. We would be there. So I had all that interest, or the interest in theatre and movies, and I was lucky to have that with my mum and dad. But dance was something that I loved from movies like Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly movies, and MGM and things like that, and all the musicals that I was loving and going to see. But ballet was not something that my family knew anything about. And we didn't even have classical music in our house. You know, we had a one LP of the Planets, and that was it. But otherwise, but it was a very musical household. We were always singing, always playing music loudly throughout my childhood. So it was a very sort of, I said the word artistic sounds a bit strong, but as a family. But it was a family that loved entertainment, loved showbiz, loved all those things. So I was. But ballet was something I'd never tried. And when I was 18, I was sort of into kind of self-education of sorts. You know, I thought if I haven't read a book by so-and-so, I should try it. And haven't seen an opera, I should try that. And I did the same with ballet. I thought, well, Swan Lake, that's famous. I'll go and see that, see if I like it. When I was 18, went on my own.
Is that the first ballet you ever saw?
Yes, more or less. So I kind of fell in love with it in a way that I'd loved a lot of musicals before that and the dancing. And I would go back to see these shows and wait for the numbers, you know, because I knew the show well. So I was sort of, the revelation with the ballet was that it was dancing from beginning to end. It sounds very naive to say that now, but it's true. That's how I thought, oh, they don't stop and I don't have to wait through the scenes anymore. You know, it's all about dance and quite often about storytelling as well.
So what made you decide to go and train?
I tried acting classes at Mount View when I was about 15. I didn't really like using my voice, so that was a key, you know, just telling me something. I worked in a theatre agency, you know, selling theatre tickets. I worked at the National Theatre as an usher and on the bookshop for many years, did all those things. So it wasn't an instant thing. I thought I'd missed the boat. You know, I was already, as I said, 18 by the time I'd seen the first ballet. But I wanted to be part of that world, the theatre world and the ballet dance world in some way. I felt I wanted to be part of it. Thought I'd missed the boat. But I met someone at the National Theatre, actually, who was also an usher. And all the ushers tended to be training as actors or singers or dancers or whatever, you know. So I met this guy who was the same age as me and he was in training. He'd only just started. And I thought, oh, okay, that's what I'd like to do. I should do that. That's what I want to do. And I went for an audition for a place called the Laban Centre. It's called Trinity Laban now. And
where is that? Whereabouts is that?
It's in Deptford, mm-hmm. In South London. The audition was my first ever dance class. I'd never actually been to a dance class before.
Gosh.
I got in, unbelievably. But I do think it was because when I was interviewed, I was so clear how passionate I was about dance. I'd read everything. I'd seen everything many times. I was going 3 or 4 times a week, you know, to see things. Modern dance, ballet. Always at Sadler's Wells or the Royal Opera House.
How did you afford all this?
I think I was working a bit later, you know, I started work at 18. And so I was earning money and I kept working at the National Theatre. Even when I started training, I was still working there for a bit of pocket money to go and see more dance, see more plays and movies, yeah.
So when do you think you made the decision not to carry on dancing yourself, but become a choreographer?
Oh, well, it's interesting. I you know, when I started out with my company, with the one I still run, it's called New Adventures now. Mm. It was called Adventures in Motion Pictures to begin with. And I was one of the dancers as well as a sort of a small collective of choreographers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the way it started. And I was happy doing that. And I got that out of my system, the performing thing, which I sort of loved for a while and really enjoyed doing. But I actually realized that once I was not in the piece that I was also choreographing, I could choreograph better. I could actually see what I was doing rather than having to turn around and be in it. Several things came at the same time. One was that I got offered to choreograph Oliver the first time round in 1994 for Cameron McIntosh at the Palladium with Jonathan Pryce.
That's a big leap into the big time. How did you meet Cameron McIntosh and how did all that happen?
Well, I'd actually done a musical before that. I'd done a musical called Children of Eden, a Stephen Schwartz musical that was not very successful in the West End. Lasted about 3 months. So I had done that. So Cameron had seen my work in that. But more likely he'd been interested in some of the shows that I'd done with my company. Uh-huh. And although we were quite a small company until Swan Lake came along, we had a little bit of a reputation. We got an Olivier nomination actually for a small piece we'd done in 1991. It's sort of quite early on. So people were sort of aware. So I suppose he took a punt on me, really, to do a big show like that. And Sam Mendes was the director.
So there was Oliver came first, and then?
Well, Oliver was 94. I'd already done Nutcracker by that point at the Edinburgh Festival in 92. But Swan Lake came the year after Oliver, so 95. And that was the one that changed everything in a big way, you know, internationally, in terms of it's kind of hitting some sort of zeitgeist of some kind and having a wider story beyond just the arts pages. You know, it was sort of a big thing that was so unexpected, really.
So where did that take you? How did things change? Because suddenly everybody knew who you were and about it.
Well, good and bad, actually, because it was suddenly we had this success thrust upon us. We were suddenly offered to do a West End run. Mm-hmm. Now, most dancers I knew at that time had never done 8 shows a week. People got ill or injured very quickly.
Yeah.
We had no experience of doing that many performances. We didn't have enough covers, so we were constantly bringing people in, and so it was a lot of stress and it had its difficult side, but we were lifted up by the audiences every day who just loved the show, and we learned as we went along, you know, and it opened up the world to us, really. We got invited to Los Angeles to do the piece. It was the first piece we'd ever been outside of the UK. And we did a season in Los Angeles in which all of Hollywood came to see us. Backstage every night, you have people all lining up to want to meet you, and legendary people, you know. So it was sort of in at the deep end in a crazy kind of way.
But must have been for you extraordinary, because, you know, given you spent a lot of your youth lurking about outside stage doors, and now they're all, you know, those people are coming to see you and your show. That must have been fantastic.
I mean, to a certain extent, I carried on the autograph collecting, but I did it in a different way. I had a visitor's book, and I'd ask people to write something in the visitor's book. But it's a similar thing. But it was all very personal. It was lovely, you know. They were coming to see us, you know, coming to see my show. So I was sort of, it was a very different experience. But of course, then Swan Lake was in Billy Elliot, which I have to mention, because that came about, four or five years after Swan Lake had premiered. That made the image of that swan, which Adam Cooper plays the grown-up Billy at the end, it made it something that was people you could talk about anywhere in the world and they would remember it.
Yes.
And so it opened up other doors to us then all around the world to take that piece to, and some of our other pieces as well.
Have you got brothers and sisters, Matthew?
Yeah, I've got one brother.
Is he creative?
In his way. He's retired now, actually. He took early retirement. He worked in a merchant bank in the city from the age of 16 onwards.
Gosh.
I used to put him in my shows when I was a kid. He was always my female partner. I used to stick a wig on him and put him in a dress and dance with him. It hasn't changed his life, particularly in later life. But he always says now, whenever I tell the story, that he had the legs for it. Apparently, it's not completely true. But
I mean, what did your parents think of your success?
They loved it.
Yeah,
they're incredibly supportive parents who celebrated everything that we did and everything that I did, and they lived long enough to see a lot of the success, and they were there in the opening night on Broadway. They were at the Tony Awards. They were in Los Angeles a lot. They were both at the opening of Mary Poppins when I did it. And I was so grateful that they had that, because it was a gorgeous time for them. You know, they had a wonderful time.
Were they there when you were knighted?
Not knighted, but they were there for when I got the OBE. They were both there then.
Oh, how lovely. So let's talk about Mary Poppins for a minute, because that's massive, and it's still on tour, isn't it?
It is at the moment. It's in Cardiff this Christmas, I think. Yeah. Yeah. No, incredible show. I mean, I remember saying to Cameron when he sort of talked about the possibility of it happening, I said, I'll do anything to be involved in that show. You know, I'll make tea and coffee or whatever. I'd love to be part of it in some way or other. And it was a very big team that he got together. You know, we had two choreographers. I worked with Stephen Meir, my friend Stephen Meir, co-choreographers. I was co-directing with the amazing Sir Richard Eyre. And we had two sets of composers, the Sherman brothers, you know, who the legendary Sherman brothers, and also Styles and Drew, who did the new songs. There was a big team, two lots of producers, because we had Cameron and Thomas Schumacher from Disney. So it's a lot of people to keep happy. But we all got on very well, and we loved the material. And Julian Fellowes wrote the book. And surprisingly, for such a big team of quite notable people, we all kind of loved each other, and we all had a great time. We all loved the piece so much, you know. I mean, the interesting thing about it is the way I view most of the work that I do for my company, which usually are based on very famous pieces or stories or ballets or books or films or whatever it is to, but none of them actually mirror completely those pieces, you know, so they're their own take on them. And Poppins was the same, you know, there's very little in the show of Poppins, which is in the film of Mary Poppins. It's the same for the Red Shoes a little bit, you know, we recreate some things, but it's its own thing. The Red Shoes ballet is completely different from what happens in the film version. And I think that can be the mistake of a lot of films to stage adaptations sometimes. They try and sort of recreate the film, and it's different medium, you know. So you've got to sort of find a way of making something that's cinematic, theatrical. And that's the fun of it. That's the joy of it. That's the creative joy of it.
Well, just from looking at all the different things you've done, you really relish finding a different setting, don't you? So sort of putting Nutcracker in a Victorian orphanage or and we'll get on to talk about Carman in a minute, you know, in a weird Midwestern town somewhere.
Yes. Well, I call it the big idea. Uh-huh. What is the big idea about the piece? And so Cinderella, my version of Cinderella, for example, which is set to the Prokofiev Ballet score, the big idea in that was to set it during the Blitz in London. And all other ideas come from that one big idea. Uh-huh. So you start to cast it in a sense of characters and what sort of jobs they might have, or how they got involved or not in the war. It gives them a whole history, someone going missing, a shoe in the rubble. It really feeds into the story. So I look for that kind of thing that's going to change the whole concept of the piece, you know. And with Swan Lake, it was male swans. With Sleeping Beauty, it was sort of time-traveling vampire story about how do you stay, you know, alive in 100 years' time and to be there for the one you love and all. So it's all sorts of the big idea tends to then create lots of other little ideas.
Let's just quickly talk about Patrick Hamilton, because we're both great fans of his slightly lesser known works.
Well, the novels, I think you're talking about, the lesser well known than the than the plays and the movie adaptations of Rope and Gaslight. They're the most famous pieces he did. But I fell in love with these novels about real Londoners, real people in pubs in London that he frequented. He wasn't part of any literary circles. No. He wasn't that 1930s Noel Coward thing, cigarette holders and all that sort of world. He was the listened to ordinary people in pubs around the sort of Euston area, really. And it sounds strange for me to talk about voices because I don't deal in voices very often. I deal in movement and characters, but I found them very inspiring, the stories of people who go to a pub to meet someone, meet up with other people, looking for love, whatever it is, you know, the days before apps and easy phone calls. And, you know, I found that whole world fascinating. That's where that piece came from that I did called The Midnight Bell.
But that was, it's interesting because I think you rather in that situation, rather than change the setting, you slightly fell in love with the setting itself because it was set with all those very Patrick Hamilton-y sort of, you know, lampposts, I remember. And
The big idea, I suppose, of that was to take characters from various novels that he'd written. Mm. So it's one person's work and put them in a situation and see what happens.
I mean, I know this is a ridiculous question because, you know, it's like asking somebody who your favourite child is, but out of all the amazing things you've invented, have you got one that you particularly really cherish? Or
I like them for different reasons, you know, but I think the one I have the most affection for is probably pieces that people don't know about, is the very early pieces. And we made up a program called Early Adventures, which is all the first pieces I did. And I think it's because I performed in them. So I have a physical memory of the choreography. And it was the when I used to make choreography kind of on my own body, rather than working with dancers who were much better than I ever was, which is what I do now. But it's more personal in that way. And I have such an affection for the choice of music in the days when I couldn't, you know, have a big score or live music or anything like that. Lots of favourite recordings and things like that. So it comes very much from me and the things I love.
And how often is that performed? And you know, where can we, might we next see that?
Well, I'd love to do it. It's a harder sell, you know, even after all this time, a title is important. And a title like Swan Lake or Sleeping Beauty or Cinderella sells a lot better, even than something like The Red Shoes or Play Without Words, a piece that I did years back, or The Midnight Bell. Less straightforwardly identifiably something that people know.
Yes.
So you have to work a lot harder with those shows to make people interested in them. But I mean, having said that, the amazing thing that's happened, the thing I'm most proud of in this time of running this company, is the audience, the growth of the audience and the trust that the audience has in my work.
Yeah.
And that they don't really mind what it is now. They'll come to whatever show it is we're doing.
Yeah.
Because they're open-minded about discovering it. And I think that's an amazing thing to have.
You're very modest, Matthew.
I think you have to be grateful for, you know, I recognize what is really important. I mean, I've always wanted to run a company from the very early days of, you know, when I used to put on little shows as a kid, a company is very important to me. I've turned down lots of things because I don't want to lose my company. And it's a privilege. If I sound modest, I am grateful for that, very much so. I usually work with the same people in terms of my creative team around me in the company. And sometimes people say, well, that's not very, maybe not adventurous enough. You know, you should work with different people. But I love having that shorthand with the team.
Yes.
Where we all know what we like and we know, and that's why the work has got better and stronger. And each time we bring back a piece, we all want to improve it and we all sort of work together. So Les Brotherston, you know, my designer that I work with all the time, and Paulie Constable, the genius lighting designer that I work with, she's amazing. And, you know, so it's teamwork, but I think it's because we've worked together over a long period of time.
Yeah. So let's get on now to The Calm Man, which is a brilliant, brilliant title for something that's only based on carbon. That this has got 1,000 firsts in it, isn't it? I mean, it's first seen in as far back as 2000, and it's starting to tour in June.
Yes, that's right. I think it hasn't toured for quite a long time, about 15 years or so. And it's a thriller, you know. And it's at the time it was trying to do something. I'd done Swan Lake and I'd done Cinderella, so we played a lot of princesses and prince and people from another era and everything. So we wanted to do something that was a bit more earthy, a bit more sexy, down to earth kind of characters, and try and tell a story that had twists and turns in it, like a movie thriller. That was the big idea.
But I think the first ballet ever to have a bisexual anti-hero.
Yes, I'm probably giving away one of our big plot twists, actually, by saying that. But in the dance world, there's very little same-sex partner relationships stories being told, still, after all this time. Since, you know, 30 years on Swan Lake, people talk about it as it was sort of a bit shocking, I suppose, at the time. People walked out and things like that. And now it's become like, bring the kids at Christmas, you know, show. It's that kind of thing. But in the ballet world, has not changed barely at all in that time. It's still a rarity to see that. So Carman has that element in it. And most of my shows do have a sort of, do touch on same-sex relationships and different kinds of relationships, different kinds of stories. I think there's so much further we can go with dance and storytelling without words.
Yeah.
It's not all fairy tales. You know, even in the fairy tales, you can be a little bit, you can push the boundaries a little bit more, maybe.
Yeah.
And audiences will go with it. This has been proven. It's been proven through these pieces, you know, that they love it. Yeah.
So what are you going to do next? What's next on your horizon to...
Well, I get asked this a fair bit, and I haven't really got a new piece in my head at the moment. And I more or less have a full-time job with the company, you know, and casting the shows and restaging. And I always, you know, change things in the productions. Always, I think one of the reasons they're successful is that they're constantly renewed over the years. I suppose what I'm doing at the moment is I'm letting something come if it comes. You know, I'm sort of keeping my eyes and ears are always open to a new idea. But I've done a lot of the ones I really wanted to do. And it has to be something I think, that could really work. That's a good idea. I don't want to just do it for the sake of it.
No.
I don't need to, really. You know, I feel quite content with what I've done. Some might say boringly content. You know, I should be sort of having big plans for new works, but I've always been very choosy about what I do, and I have to have a real passion for it. So those things are harder to find.
Matthew, thank you so much for coming on Radio Oldie. And so Red Shoes is on until when at Sadler's Wells?
It's until I think it's the 18th of January. Then it's on tour till May. Mm-hmm. Around the UK, and then The Calm Man starts very soon after that in June, also touring, and then Sad as Well summer show next year.
Oh, well, good luck with all of that, and thank you again, Matthew.
Pleasure. Thank you, Charlotte. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Matthew Bourne. If you've enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks again to Matthew Bourne, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers. and enter Old Trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter Old Trial.